housekeeping before we begin. If anyone would like to speak and on a topic, please, if you're on camera, raise your hand. If you're on the phone, please indicate that you would like to speak and wait for the chairperson to call on you before you do speak. If you are a guest of an item or looking to speak and you're not a committee member, we ask that you hold your comment or hold the topic you want to speak about until after the committee has discussed an item. And once again, raise your hand if you're on camera or indicate that you want to speak and wait for the chairperson to recognize you. With that being said, I'm going to give the indication to AGP to start the video. And then I will cede it to our chairperson, Mary Jean Sage.
All right, thank you, Michael. Thank you all for being here tonight. Good to see your shining faces, each and every one of you. We will start off with public comment for this evening. Because we are virtual, we have a little different procedure for public comment. Public comment does need to come in via email. Michael, is there public comment to be read?
I have not received public comment.
Okay, good. With that, we will move on to our consent items. We have two this evening. Approval of the Health Commission member appointment to the Board of Supervisors, and then the reappointment of Commissioner Campbell. We have with us this evening Mr. O'Malley, who is our candidate to go to the Board of Supervisors. So if no one has anything they would like to pull from the consent item, I will entertain a motion to approve our consent items.
So move.
Okay, thanks, Sue.
That was Lynn.
Lynn, I'm sorry. I'm looking right at you. All right. Susan is going to second that. All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you. And with that, before we go on, I will introduce Mr. O'Malley. And if you'd like to say a few words, we want to, it's not official yet. It does have to go to the Board of Supervisors, but I don't see why that it wouldn't be approved there. So kind of a premature, but welcome aboard. I'm glad to have you with us.
Well, thank you for the acceptance of the nomination by the nominating committee. And it'd be nice to get back to the county health agency. I retired, as you may well know, from being administrator at the county mental health department some darn near 20 years ago. It's amazing how time goes by, but I look forward to joining in and working with you in the future.
Okay, good. We look forward to having you. So again, welcome, and we will see you next month. Moving on to item 4 on our agenda this evening, it's to receive any updates from topics from our previous meeting. Do any of the commissioners have anything to add from some of the things that we've talked about over the last few months? I know it's been quite some time since we've all met in person, but we have had a number of virtual meetings. Commissioner Raymond.
Yes, I just wanted to report. Last time we were talking about the importance of flu vaccines and that we needed to, you know, be mindful of what's going on in our community. I did make an announcement at the Adult Services Policy Council. But in addition to that, I did make a phone call to I work at French Hospital, so I want to see what infection control was doing as far as community outreach. And I talked with Vicki Warnock, and she was talking that I should see what our fellow or neighbors are doing in Santa Barbara County. So I made a call and I contacted Jan Kogler, and she was talking about some of the things that I don't know, you know, whether this is something we've entertained, but they wanted us to, they are concentrating on senior housing. 14 senior housing units have now had access to vaccines. Over 550 vaccines have been given or will be given. That's the kind of thing that they're working on. The other community drive up and drive through, they have some pods that they're doing. So not only did they have state vaccine source, and I don't know whether we get it from the state or is that something we order through the county. And then the other thing is actually Sansum Clinic donated 1,000 doses of the vaccine too. So just kind of an update of what, you know, behind the scenes, what's going on, and something that we as a health commission should be mindful of.
Good. Thank you for that. And we'll maybe check with Rick when he gets his report to see where we are, if we're going to do our usual community clinics this evening, or this year, not this evening. Commissioner Campbell, you had something.
Well, I was going to ask Rick about availability of the vaccine and the whether we have an adequate supply, and when the and the department feels is the optimal time to get your shot, given that its effectiveness seems to wear off after perhaps 4 months or so. But perhaps that would be better taken up during his presentation.
We hope that we'll give him time to think about it, and he'll be ready for us when he gives his report. Okay. Good questions, though, Bob. I had those myself. Well, I went to the pharmacy to get mine last week, only to get there, and they didn't have the high dose that was recommended for seniors. So maybe we can talk about that. Good. Well, one of the things that came up last month, actually post our meeting, but we all got a copy of it, we did have some public comment from a resident that was concerned about families being able to visit in the nursing facilities. And because of that, I invited Karen Jones to be with us this evening, who's she's in charge of our SLO Ombudsman program. And I wonder, Karen, if you can just tell us a little bit about what's going on with the facilities. I know we've had some cases that have been recorded in the facilities. I'm sure we're not at the point where we're opening up yet for family to visit residents. I understand the concerns, but there certainly is that safety issue that we always have to be concerned about. So can you share a little with us, please?
Sure, and thank you for having me. So the visitation stuff, if you look way far back into the 70s and 80s, forever, the nursing homes have had no say in visitors for the residents. Even family members, the only people who can control visitors before COVID was the resident or a judge. Even a healthcare agent or a conservator didn't have that power, except for a conservator could get it from a judge. So visitations have always been sort of the holy grail of nursing homes, and it's such a protected right. It was really shocking in March when CMS said no visitors in facilities with COVID. And so we've really tried to adjust, and San Luis County, you know, worked really hard on creating their own regulations or requirements for the nursing homes for no visitation, except when there's a hospice situation or somebody with this, the licensing agency created an ability for somebody with a disability to have a support person present. However, end of life, which you think would be obvious, but it's really not. You know, when someone's on hospice, at what point do they need to have somebody present? And if they have a disability, what does that mean if they have a support person? So both CMS and the licensing agency for the nursing homes, and really even the county, no one's really been able to define, is that the last few days? Is that what disabilities are included? So it's been a struggle for people in facilities to see their loved ones. And we're going on, you know, we're past 6 months now since the facilities closed down. And we're trying to figure out a balance, a safe way for people to visit their loved ones in the facilities without the spread of the virus. We've seen the data. We know the cases in facilities, with few exceptions, are coming from staff. And so the argument that, it, you know, if staff are safe to come into the building, then so are the families. doesn't work really well because the staff are the ones bringing it in. But we're really fortunate here in San Luis Obispo County that we've had so few instances of the virus outbreak in actual care facilities. We've had a few, but they seem to, you know, they're not what we thought was going to happen after we saw the reports coming out of Italy and out of New York and out of Washington State. So we have been incredibly fortunate that our facilities, for the most part, not for everybody, but for the most part, have been rather safe places to be. And it's just time to reevaluate what the plan is going forward. This isolation is not healthy or safe for these folks who are now having trouble with failure to thrive. So thank goodness we've for the most part kept them safe from COVID, but failure to thrive is not any less unhealthy for people. We have residents in facilities who are saying to our ombudsman, I hope I can see my grandson one more time before I die. And they're not even in a hospice situation. I had a gentleman tell me yesterday that, or Friday, that his wife is declining at such a fast rate. She's not on hospice. She's not end of life. But she's declining with failure to thrive because she doesn't think she's going to be able to see her husband on their anniversary in October. And we've got to do better than this. We have to figure out a way to make it safe for folks to visit their loved ones in facilities without the spread of the virus. But not just a visit with a window between people because, you know, facility residents aren't zoo animals. They need to have facility visits in place outside when it's okay for the weather. We're lucky we live here and not in some other places where the weather just hates people. But even here, with right now with the smoke, it's not particularly safe to be outside having a visit. And we need to figure out a way for people to hug, for people to hold hands, and to touch faces. Our bodies are meant for that, and we need to find a way to make that safe for people. And whether it's making sure they have the right PPE, the right amount of hand washing, the right amount of screening or testing, we need to make it happen. And so we've been working, our office has been working very closely with Rick and the other folks at the health agency to figure out a solution here in San Luis County that works with what the licensing agency and CMS are both working on also. So I'm glad we're here. We have a lot better history with this virus than in many places, but you know, it's still new territory for all of us. And frankly, I just keep saying this is one of those really great, I wish we were a year from now viruses, because we can look back and go, I wish we'd done that differently. You know, hindsight's going to be 2020 with this, but we don't have that yet. And so when we do, it'll be great, but not yet.
So is there anything the Health Commission can do to help you along this path of figuring out what to do?
Right now, we just need a little bit of time. We're working on researching both what CMS and the CDPH, which is the state licensing agency for nursing homes, and also Department of Social Services at the state level, which licenses the residential facilities. We're trying to figure out what that balance is, and maybe I could come back next month and report on what that balance became, you know, how we make it safe, how we follow the requirements, and what we might need to look at changing in order to get things to work the right way. My utter goal is that this family that wants to get together on their anniversary can see each other in person. And so we're working individually on individual cases, and I've gotten a few folks into the facilities to be with their loved ones, but I have a lot more clients. So we're looking at it kind of as a whole, but also on individual situations, you know, figure out individual solutions. But as soon as we have a better idea of what the requirements are going to be that we have to follow and we kind of make it work in our area, I will happily report back to you guys and see what we could do to work together.
Good. Well, we'd appreciate that. And thank you for all you're doing for them now, as far as that goes. I have one other quick question, and then I'll open it up to other commissioners if they should have some questions. I was a little concerned about this residence concern that the nursing home resident went to the hospital and it didn't seem to me like her correct medications followed her. What are the guidelines or what are the state regs about order occurs when home patient then has to be admitted to the hospital?
Well, typically from the nursing homes, and medications is a problem in every direction when it comes to care facilities and the hospital. And I think it'd be helpful to have someone from maybe Dignity and Tenet to speak at one of your meetings about what their procedures are. Typically the facility, depending on how quickly they need to move that person to the hospital. So it's an emergency, there's an ambulance coming. Depending on how much time they have, they'll put together a packet of information to send with that person to the hospital. I don't know in this one situation exactly what happened, but in experiences I've heard of with other folks, because I don't have any jurisdiction with hospitals, it appears that sometimes the hospitals pull up any old records they have and use those. And sometimes they don't get updated when the facility sends the current medication list. And that breakdown can happen on the other side too. We have situations where the facility will, with a returning resident, not always get the updated information into their system. So, medications are always a problem, and I always recommend for people with not so much hospital. You go to the hospital, we need to go to the hospital, but when they're discharging back into or newly into a care facility of any kind, is be careful with late afternoons and weekends. That tends to be the time that there's more errors made on the receiving side of facilities, simply because there may be less management in the building. The pharmacy may not get the orders to deliver the medicines, because remember, the medicines themselves aren't traveling back and forth. It's the list of the medicines that are traveling back and forth. And so if you've got a medication and it doesn't get delivered for 3 days, you can have some real problems.
Okay. Well, thank you for that explanation. That helps a lot. And I saw our nurses shaking their heads as you were talking about some of those things. So any other commissioners have any questions? Commissioner Raymond?
Yes, I just want to, did you want to talk about the tablets that you're making arrangements so that you can have a little bit of visitation via technology? That's something you want to share?
Sure. Thank you for bringing it up, Jean. So we received some ombudsmen around the nation, actually received some CARES Act money, which is still in the process of flowing. But we put in our proposal to purchase 30 tablets, some with service, that would be going into the care facilities, both residential and nursing homes, and kind of be assigned to those facilities, so that the residents can have more access to online, sort of virtual meetings with their family, in some situations, virtual meetings with their ombudsman, although we are back in the buildings now after a several-month stop, because we were also stopped from going in. And we have some residents who, have some support groups that they participate in that they'll be able to start participating in again. So we're really excited to get that rolled out. Still waiting for the contract on that, but we expect it soon. And then we'll get those purchased, get our IT folks to set them up so that they've got some safety stuff on them, and then get them out to residents in the facility. So looking forward to that.
So that's a good idea. I wonder, would it be acceptable for a resident to have their own laptop or pad or whatever? And I mean, there's always the privacy issue and the safety issue, but is that in the purview of what the facility could arrange for?
Absolutely. In many areas, the Ombudsman Program has been able to do a drive where they've accepted donations of used tablets. And then they have their IT folks kind of wipe them so they're safe and clean, and then they send them in to the facility, and they're just kind of given to the facilities. So if anyone would like to donate tablets, we can use what my friends in other places have done and get those out to folks also if they want to sort of beef up our program. There's roughly 100 residential facilities for the elderly in San Luis County, with a little over 1,500 to 2,000 people in them at any given time. And there are 6 nursing homes currently, 7 normally, with about 600 to 700 people in them. So there's a lot of room for a lot more tablets than just the 30 that we can provide. So if anyone would like to donate a used tablet, it doesn't need to have service because the facilities do have pretty decent Wi-Fi these days, and they can get onto the resident Wi-Fi. They won't be using the facilities, you know, secure Wi-Fi, but they'll still have some access to the internet.
How about if I get together with Tamar and we figure out how we could reach out to some of the service clubs in our county to make that known to them? I think that might be an opportunity. And I know Tom is involved with a service club up in Atascadero, but that might be an area where they could really help. All right, Commissioner Campbell, did you have a question?
Yeah, I wonder if Karen could clarify a comment I think I heard, that not even she was allowed in these facilities for several months. Are there any advocates for these patients who have on-site access? Or if you want to advocate for a patient there, do you have to do it all remotely with the staff and maybe try to communicate through clerical staff who are very busy and so forth? Sounds like a real nightmare to me.
It really was. I've done this for over 21 years, and I probably was one of the more shocked people when in March, when it was decided that ombudsmen were not allowed in facilities, just like everybody else was not allowed in facilities, hairdressers and podiatrists. And, you know, again, what we know from March, we now know we should have done differently, but that's what this virus is going to be like. So we were not allowed into the nursing homes or the residential facilities for the first time since 1978 in March. We were able to resume our visits here in San Luis County at the end of July. It was a very long time. At the same time that we were not allowed to visit the facilities, the licensing agencies weren't doing any in-person visits, and families weren't allowed in. And a lot of the regulations that protected the residents and their rights were also waived. So it's been weird. I don't know any other way to put it. It's been hard. The residents and the staff have done the best they can. But we had job security since 1978 for a reason. You know, there's always room for advocacy and for making things better. And so we're very glad to be back at the facilities. And where we've been so far, we were initially limited to just a few visits or one visit a day. We've just recently expanded that to multiple facilities in a day with adequate PPE and testing and training and all that stuff, because we are not going to be a vector for this virus. So what we're finding is good. You know, we're not finding nightmares. We're seeing that, again, San Luis County, we've got some good providers. We've got some really good things still happening. And we're really happy that we can get back in those buildings.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a lesson learned going forward. There might need to be some regulation changes or whatever as we once we get over this and we go forward, and by stepping back and seeing what we could have done differently or whatever, that certainly is an area where I think it would be ripe for some changes of some kind. So good. Okay, anybody else have questions for Karen? Well, thank you again for being with us this evening. For me, it was very enlightening. I appreciate you being here very much. Tamar and I'll get together along with Candace to see from a community education standpoint what we might do for some of our groups out there that might be helped with, you know, be able to help with the virtual meeting situation. If anybody else has any other ideas, so I certainly make sure that you reach out to one of us so that we can talk about it as well. So thank you. Have a good rest of your evening.
Thank you. I'll let you guys go. Enjoy your meeting.
All right. And we'll appreciate if you can come back in a month or so and tell us, you know, what where we are with some of these plans. We do try to revisit our topics every now and then, so we keep on top of everything. So thank you.
Okay, and I'll reach out to you with email, and we'll kind of coordinate for next month.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. So moving on, Dr. Rosen, we're happy to have you with us again this evening, and you will update us on where we are with what we have and all things new in the public health department.
Sure. So in COVID news, we added 56 cases over the weekend. So our current case count is 3,278. So we have 8 individuals in the hospital and 3 in the intensive care unit. So that's a snapshot of where we are. We continue to engage in response testing and congregate care settings. As we've gone along, both the California Men's Colony and Atascadero State Hospital have gotten a better handle on testing with fairly good turnaround time on results for their staff, and in the case of CMC, their inmates as well on site. So that I think represents good progress. While there was an outbreak at the California Men's Colony recently, it's definitely on the downward slope at this point. In other news on the COVID front, the big developments obviously have been in the area of schools. So I believe last time we met, I talked about the waiver application process. We're more or less through that for the time being. We haven't seen any new applications since we last spoke. And we're now, the newest development on the state level is talking about cohorts on school campuses that apply really to K through 12 and can occur outside of the waiver process as long as the groups are limited to no more than 14 students in size and no more than 2 supervising adults. With some modifications for special education type settings. So that has already gotten underway, and we don't necessarily play an approval role for those programs, but it's more consultative, and we just ask that schools make us aware of what's happening on the cohort front. Those, I think, are the more significant. And obviously the other important development since we last spoke is Cal Poly. So Cal Poly starts classes this week. Students were moving onto campus last week. So we have seen a spike in activity with respect to Cal Poly. And they are actively isolating and quarantining patients as cases arise. And we have been cooperating closely with the medical team at Cal Poly. In addition, they have Cal Poly students have been making use of the state-sponsored testing sites, the OptumServe testing sites, and those their Cal Poly students are using about 60 to 65% of those testing slots at the moment, but there's still availability of testing appointments next day currently at 2 of the sites. I think that's basically it for COVID news. With respect to influenza vaccination, we're in the process of lining up our point of distribution exercise, which we'll plan on being a drive-through. influenza vaccination event. In addition, we are due to receive our high-dose flu vaccine this week. So we're likely to start providing high-dose flu shots as early as this week, most likely next week. And that is all I can think of at the moment. So any questions? Do you want me to start with your question about flu vaccine?
Go ahead.
So that is a very good question. And right now, so the question being, when is the optimal time to get your flu shot? We don't have a solid answer with messaging around that yet. So I think that is something that we need to do very soon. But if you ask me for my opinion, my answer is I don't know. So from our standpoint, there is benefit to everyone, to folks getting their flu shot early, because it means that for the next several months, we're less likely to see as much confusion when people develop flu-like symptoms. But from an individual standpoint, given that we typically see our highest level of flu activity in January and February, that there is, you know, that is a good argument to wait at least until October to get one's flu shot. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. So I'm curious to see what our messaging will be around that. We have to land on what we're going to message.
Good. Commissioner, go ahead.
Are you anticipating having a generous supply of vaccine? And so, probably all of us here on the commission are really interested in the high dose vaccine.
Right. So I don't know the specific high dose numbers. I know that we'll have about 3,000 doses of flu specifically through our department at 2191. Cal Poly is going to have a little north of 5,000 doses that they will be administering on campus. And then we will have the ability to order more vaccine for a November-December delivery. Which is a bit late in the process. And that's basically where we are for the time being.
Do you have any sense, Rick, of what the overall supply picture is? 3,000 for your department and 5,000 for Cal Poly in a county of 300,000 people.
Exactly right. So my sense is that there is not. There has been a minor delay in distribution, apparently because of the fires, but that's just a matter of days rather than what we've sometimes seen as weeks or months. My sense is that there's that the vaccine is widely available and there haven't been any problems in terms of supply chain.
On the messaging, Rick, I know because we're seniors and we have lots of senior friends. The people, those of us who go to the pharmacy rather than our primary care physician, and in fact, a lot of primary care physicians don't even do flu vaccines anymore because pharmacists can, you know, give the vaccine. I'm finding that out in the communities, the pharmacies aren't doing a really good job of messaging about the high dose versus the other. I know a number of seniors who have gone and gotten a flu vaccine already, and they say, ooh, I have no idea which one I got. Nobody said anything about being one versus the other. Myself, when we went to get ours at the pharmacy, once, even though we made the appointment online and went there, when we got there, they said, oh, we don't happen to have the high dose in yet. It'll be next week. And so they suggested we wait and, you know, come back again. But how strong is the messaging for those who need to be getting the high dose versus the other?
So it's definitely a recommendation put out nationally, you know, by ACIP. And we do, you know, we certainly relay that, but in terms of, I think it's a fair question in terms of really saturating the community with messaging around encouraging seniors to get high-dose flu vaccine in particular. That may be, you know, that's concerning this year because COVID is drowning out everything else.
But how can
I think it's a good point.
Messaging when our senior centers are closed and all those places where right. seniors gather, they're not doing that now.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Any money in the budget to do a media campaign, whether it's online or through the newspaper or what?
So I'll certainly pass that on.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and that fits into the broader picture of messaging around flu, which is a big deal this year.
Other questions from commissioners? Commissioner Campbell.
Yes, Rick, going back to COVID-19, can you speak about the details of surveillance for both Cal Poly and students and staff, as well as the K-6 schools? What, do we have any details available as to what the nature of the surveillance is, et cetera, how rigorous it is, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. So I can start with K-6 schools, which I think are more, there's a more clear-cut recommendation, and that is that staff be tested, 25% of staff be tested every 2 weeks. So half of staff every month. That is the current recommendation for surveillance from the state. And that is what we're expecting schools to offer. And that will be built into the waiver application process going forward and as more schools come online. In terms of Cal Poly and higher education, currently where we are is surveillance testing is only required, well, I shouldn't say required, I should say is only being carried out for specific groups on campus. So first of all students moving into the dorms on campus had to present with a test. And if they did not get tested, then they were tested immediately on arrival by the health center. So there was baseline testing for students on campus. In terms of surveillance testing, that is happening with all of the groups that we consider to be at increased risk. So that would be things like athletes, student athletes, and they are having music courses. So that, for example, there's a band class So in band class, they will be undergoing surveillance testing. The surveillance testing in those settings is 25% of students and staff every week. So it's a little bit more frequent. In addition, they're engaging in response testing in the dorms. So if a student is identified as having COVID, they're immediately isolated and their close contacts are quarantined. And then the remainder of the floor undergoes response testing, similar to what we would do at a skilled nursing facility.
So I think I heard you say a quarter of those high-risk groups are tested every week.
Mm-hmm.
What about the students who are not falling into those groups? Is there any
ongoing surveillance
or, you know, strong outline as to how they are surveilled?
Right now, there's no, so at least at the moment, I am not aware of a specific plan for broad-based surveillance testing for students. So I know that that's been discussed at Cal Poly. I do not know where that has landed. The big accomplishment for us was getting the, show up with a test. Line drawn for the dorms.
Are they in? They're not sharing rooms in the dorms, right? Didn't I read where they're single?
So it's mostly singles, but there are some doubles, and there are some, and there are a fair number of shared bathrooms.
So if they have to isolate, do they move them?
Yes.
Okay.
Is all the voluntary testing of students to be done at those state sites that you mentioned earlier?
Right. So that's not necessarily, but to a large part, that's how it's played out. So there's also quite a bit of testing happening on campus.
Uh-huh. What about the situation, just doing a little thought experiment here.
Mm-hmm.
What if there appears to be a real outbreak on campus and the students all flood those three sites? Will they crowd out the rest of the community?
Well, that's definitely a concern, but I think the crowd-out effect is more related to surveillance testing, actually. So the response testing, Cal Poly has a plan for that and is running the tests through their own lab. So they have the ability to respond to a fairly large outbreak or multiple outbreaks. It's more the surveillance testing that I think is a concern. And we've seen that in basically the last 2 weeks. We've seen a significant... So prior to the last 2 weeks, the OptumServe testing sites were being underutilized across the board. Now they're full. At least currently, it's no longer possible to get same day appointments. So it's now about getting next day appointments. I suspect that, in a couple weeks, that will calm down a bit, and we won't see that high utilization. But it's definitely a consideration. And it's a consideration as K through 6 and K through 12 potentially schools participate in their surveillance testing. And skilled nursing facilities were just directed to test 100% of their staff every week. So that's a new development as of this weekend. So the the demand for surveillance testing is pretty significant.
Do you think we have the capacity to absorb, let's just say, an abrupt doubling of demand?
Right. Good question. So we're encouraging all that, because that is a lot of testing if you look around the whole landscape. So we're really, so we're working on trying to stockpile some self-test kits, which hopefully could alleviate, you know, a lot of that demand. But in addition, we're encouraging the various entities to develop their own means of surveillance testing, because it's just, it's a lot. Yes. I'm allowed.
At Dignity, they have now opened a lab nationally, and they specifically are looking at these things. So the capacity, I know in our facilities, they're looking for that, and they have, you know, very good turnaround time within 36 hours. So those, that's what's happening in the community as well.
I have one question, Rick.
Yes.
On the SLO website, the readyslo.org, you've added a lot more data there, like by occupation, by ethnicity, and all of that. How are you using that data?
So a lot of that is because the state is asking for that information. So the state is really emphasizing health equity measures. The whole idea of tiers, and currently we're in the purple tier, and to move to a more favorable, I guess, tier, one of the considerations is how individual counties are doing on health equity measures. That has not officially been released yet, but it will be this week, most likely. And that is when, you know, when we're talking about ethnicity, that is a factor. And many of the, most of the metrics, most of the new metrics that we're seeing on Ready Slow are related to the state's requirements for data.
Well, one of the things about data, it's wonderful, but if nobody uses that data for anything, why are we tracking it?
Right.
There's that great big graph about occupation. Is nobody looking at that and trying to figure out what we need to do? And some of those higher categories to stop the spread, or does our messaging have to be different, or whatever? Why are we not using that data for something?
Well, I think we are, but that's kind of looking at, so at a very specific level, we consider things like the availability of personal protective equipment. For a while, dentists, for example, that was a significant issue. So we were involved in helping to make sure either they had the necessary PPE or the ability to acquire it on their own. And that leveled off, and there was support from the California Dental Association, the American Dental Association, etc. So on a sort of more granular level, we, you know, there are specific measures that we do to target specific occupations. One of those occupations is student, and obviously there's a big spike in student activity related primarily because of Cal Poly. So we are, you know, we are responding to that on a specific level with working with the university in terms of isolation and quarantine and developing their plans and talking about testing and those sorts of things. So we do use that data in a general sense to say, oh, you know, there's a problem there.
So our biggest category by far is construction, a lot of the outdoor occupations.
Uh-huh.
Are we providing something for those employers, or are we messaging?
Right, so that's, so we are targeting, so we are reaching out to agricultural workers and construction workers through testing. And when we go out and do those sorts of things, the idea being we're trying to target for lack of a better word, I guess underprivileged groups with testing. And so in conjunction with those testing efforts, we are able to distribute face coverings. We are able to message about social distancing and personal protective equipment.
Okay. You see that you're using it. I was a little surprised that the next highest category is the unemployed. So how do you determine what determines unemployment?
That's a good question, and I don't know the technically what the cutoff is for determining who's unemployed, or if it's just based on self-identification, which would be my guess. But I'd have to ask Ann McDowell.
Okay. Well, I know a lot of us do look at that website a lot, but there's a lot more data coming on that website.
Right.
Although there's good data, but and hopefully we are using it in a meaningful way.
Right.
Always nice to see that data and maybe how you compare to somebody else, but what the heck does it really mean and what are we doing with it to
right.
further our cause there. All right. Are we done grilling, Rick? You hold up very well.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, we are always delighted to have you with us. Okay, good. Well, thank you again for being with us. We'll meet again next month probably, okay?
Sounds good.
Thanks.
Bye.
Moving on quickly to commissioner updates. Are there any updates from commissioners? Anybody attend meetings or whatever?
I have an update.
Okay, Susan. Let's go. Susan first and then Commissioner Raymond.
Okay. From the Homeless Services Oversight Council, there's an exciting project that's happening up in the North County. And as you know, they've gotten the that HEAP grant that came through from the state that has to be spent by the May of 2021. And the deal in Paso, where they were going to have that temporary shelter, anyway, that fell through because of the requirements from Caltrans. But they have put together a really great project, and in using those funds and also some new funds that came available, I think it was, and they're from the state, I think it's called the Home Key Funds, for repurposing motels. And there's a group, Haslow was the lead on this grant, including Echo and the City of Paso and People's Self-Help Housing. And they're going to be purchasing Motel 6 in Paso Robles. And they're just waiting for the approval on this, and using both of those different grant funds to do that. And it would provide approximately 60 permanent housing units that would be managed by People's Self-Help, and then 40 transitional housing units that Echo would then take care of. And so it was just really exciting. They had to do this really quick because they actually have to have it ready for occupancy with these units by January of 2021. And that was a requirement for this grant money coming from the state. So to see everybody pull together and pull something off this quick is kind of amazing. So. It's pretty exciting for the North County.
It is exciting. Good. Thanks, Susan.
Yeah, sure.
Commissioner Raymond, you had your hand up. Do you have something?
Yes, I did attend the Adult Services Policy Council meeting. Like I said, made the announcement about the flu shots, and everyone was in agreement that that's something they need to focus on. In addition to that, there were, the guest speakers were Gina Hambly from the Department of Social Services, talking about the populations at risk, and SynCal and explaining their senior services. Nicole Bennett gave a presentation. And that's something we might want to do at some point in time, you know, because it talks about the wraparound services, including COVID. So just an update.
Good. Thank you. Anybody else have updates? Commissioner Campbell.
Yes. I attended virtually the Tobacco Control Coalition meeting last Wednesday. The big news there is the passage and signing by the governor of Senate Bill 793, which bans virtually all flavored tobacco products with two exceptions. One is for premium cigars costing more than something like $14 a piece. And the other one, which I cannot explain, is for tobacco to be used in hookahs. But don't ask me to explain that one. Almost immediately as the governor signed this, the tobacco lobby announced a petition drive to repeal it. And if I understand how that works, if they get enough signatures, and I think it might be 5% of the number of registered voters, that the enforcement of this bill will be put off until the next general election, when it can be decided by referendum. So that's a big deal. That's certainly what Big Tobacco did in San Francisco. And I believe they were soundly defeated, but they may get a couple years to hook more kids. The other issue that I'm following is the Oceano Dunes efforts with the APCD. That process is moving along surprisingly well. It's a very complicated process with a lot of iterative review. And this week, State Parks is submitting the revision that has been requested by the APCO for their 2021 work. And there are a number of issues that need to be resolved, perhaps by the hearing board in the end of October. Some of those include definition of what the actual endpoints will be. The original agreement was rather vague. It just said a 50% reduction of emissions. How to measure that, and where to put the proposed mitigations. So that process is moving along. I wouldn't be surprised if we hear a request from both State Parks and the APCD to extend the deadline for achieving that reduction. But we won't know that until early October.
Thank you. Thank you for keeping us informed about both of those things. Anybody else? I have just a couple of things. The Preventive Health Grant CBO committee finished up their work. It went to the Board of Supervisors, and they accepted, for the most part, all of our recommendations, and so that money will be distributed in the coming months to the organizations that are receiving grants of some kind. I'll try to remember to look up the final dollar amount. So we distributed quite a bit of money, even though we were trying to be mindful of everything else that was going on. So that's done for another year. And I had just one last thing to note. I don't know if any of the rest of you saw it or not, but our own public health officer, Dr. Borenstein, has been selected as the physician of the year for San Luis Obispo County. And the public health officer in Santa Barbara, he was selected as the physician of the year for the county of Santa Barbara. It is an honor. It is especially timely this time when we see so many public health officers going through such a tough time with their communities and everything. So I will send a personal note to Dr. Borenstein, and if any of the rest of you would so like, I'm sure that she would appreciate it. It is an honor, and I am delighted to see her get the recognition for that. So good. Do we have any of our standing committees to report? Amy, anything from legislative?
I was going to update what Commissioner Campbell updated on. It is one of the nation's largest protections that we've seen, particularly coming from e-cigarettes. Go into effect January 2021, prohibiting all retail stores. So, or what the results of that will be, but it is one of the most proactive pieces of legislation that we have seen. But I'm looking forward to see what Commissioner Kimball mentioned, to see if it will have to go into referendum.
Good. Thank you. Any other of our committees? No? Okay. Well, we're getting ready for adjournment. I will just mention that it looks like we're going to be meeting virtually for the next few months. So Mike is working on updating our Zoom platform so that we will be able to do PowerPoint presentations, and perhaps we can actually have a presentation from a group with that. So if we can get that arranged in the next week or so, we'll try to put together one of the many topics that we've talked about. And it sounds like Karen had a couple of suggestions that might want to come before the board, as well as Commissioner Raymond had a number of things that she mentioned as well. So in our upcoming meetings, hopefully we will actually have a program. We will obviously still be talking about COVID for a few months to come. But with that in mind, do any other commissioners have any comments for this evening before we adjourn? If not, we will stand adjourned. Thank you all very much. Have a good rest of your evening.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone.